Numbers don't tell the whole story, but sometimes those numbers are so impressive that they're a good starting point for a really good story. 162 tournament titles, 38 NCAA postseason appearances, 27 conference championships, 28 conference players of the year, 17 conference freshmen of the year, 215 all-conference performers, 381 conference all-academic team members. That's just a small sample of the accomplishments compiled by head coach John Crooks and his players since he took over as men's golf coach at Campbell in 1990 and assumed the women's head coaching duties 1 year later. Heading into his 36th year at Campbell, John Crooks will become the longest tenured head coach in school history when the academic calendar flips this August. It's safe to say that he's built not only a mid-major powerhouse, but also one of the best college golf programs in the southeastern United States. That program has not only produced three, soon to be four, PGA Tour professionals, but hundreds of successful Campbell graduates over the last four decades. John Crooks moved to Buies Creek four decades ago, and this place became not only his home, but that of his children and their families. My name is Stan Cole, class of 1987, and this is the next installment of Tales from the Creek, where we visit with the people who've made this place special over the years. I'm delighted to be joined today by Hall of Fame golf coach John Crooks. Welcome to Tales from the Creek, John, and thanks for taking the time to visit with us.
Thank you, Stan. My honor.
John, let's just start out at the beginning. Tell us about growing up in North Carolina and how you got started in golf.
I grew up on Knollwood Street in Winston-Salem, across from Miller Park. And my father liked to play golf on the weekends, and I liked to tag along. And so he introduced me to the game, and it was a bond between us. And so that's kind of how I got started.
About how old were you then?
You were, seven, eight, something like that.
Besides golf, what else did you enjoy doing as a youngster?
Well, I mean, I played everything. I mean, we played football. I played football. I played basketball. Wasn't very good with the baseball. I loved to hit the baseball, but as far as doing the fielding, I didn't care too much for that. But and then played golf when the weather allowed.
John, I'm always curious, who helped you along the way as you became one of the best, really one of the best junior golfers in the country?
My father. I mean, he was, I played with him and his buddy, Clyde Dula, and Clyde's son, Stephen, and four of us probably played 300-400 rounds of golf together. And it was competitive, and now I was a preteen and a teenager, and by the time I turned 13, then I was able to take care of business with them, and but Dad always helped me.
Who were some of your golfing heroes?
Well, I love Sam Snead's golf swing. I love Gene Littler, his demeanor and the way he approached the public. Of course, Arnold Palmer was like the lightning bolt. He was on top of everything when he was popular in the early 60s. And then, you know, Nicholas has had a pretty good career too. So,
John, what about other sports, heroes in other sports? In the past, you've shared a story with me about getting to see Earl the Pearl Monroe play when he was at Winston-Salem State. Tell me a little bit about that.
My neighbor invited me, was a referee for the ACC, and he invited me to some games. And so I got to go to Reynolds Coliseum to watch Vic Bubas coach against Everett Case, and watch Jay Buckley play and Art Haman play, and what a great game that was. Not too late, long after that, I was the same man invited me to his church because it was a father-son meal, and he didn't have a son. And so I got to I was introduced to Coach Bones McKinney and Brian Piccolo. And I've had a chance to follow some of those people and know them well enough to say hello, and they would know me well enough to say hello back. So,
John, who were some of the best golfers you competed against growing up?
So it depends on how late we talk about me competing, but if we talk about my teenage years in my high school, Lanny Watkins was known throughout the land, and he was one of the best in Virginia. And people in North Carolina knew who I was, and I had won some stuff here. And then I got to meet people like Bruce Fleischer and Eddie Pierce and just some guys that played on the tour for 10, 15 years that when I talk to my team about them now, they have no idea who this man. I was fortunate that I grew up at a golf club that there were about 12 of us between the ages of, 14 and 18, and we played golf 5 days a week at 8 o'clock in the morning. And when you're 14 and the 18-year-olds try to take your money, you got to get pretty good in a hurry. And every one of those 12 guys went on to play on Division I golf teams. And so, I was pushed. And then my best friend in high school was a young man named Mike Callum. And the year that I won the national championship, Mike won the club championship, the county championship, and I won the state championship and the national championship. So he went to Wake Forest and I went to Houston.
John, share with us that story of the 1967 U.S. Junior Am. You go on ultimately and beat Andy North, a future U.S. Open champ in that. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, qualifying for the tournament took place in Charlotte at Quail Hollow, where they just got through playing the PGA. And both Mike and I shot the same score, and we're in a sudden-death playoff with two other friends of ours. And we went out, and Mike and I both parred the first hole, and we won the playoff. So we won the trip to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. We got out there, and it was didn't know much about Oklahoma, coming from North Carolina, and it's just one of the hottest places I've ever been. It was the temperature averaged over 100 every day, and it got to 108 and 109 a couple of days. And beautiful golf course, Twin Hills Country Club, very private, very challenging. And, you know, when you step out into that environment, you're kind of in awe of what's taking place. You know, everybody there can play, and everybody, all you can do is just pick out a target and swing the golf club. And fortunately, some good things happened when I did that.
How long did it take you to make that adjustment from kind of being in awe? I mean, when did you feel comfortable standing over the ball, throughout that turn? Do you recall?
We're talking about the U.S. Junior. And the year before, there was a huge tournament, a huge international tournament in Greensboro called the International JCs. And that had, I think, 17 different countries represented. And I happened to be, and Mike happened to be, representatives from North Carolina. And so I had been to places where everybody you looked at, you thought was as good, if not better than you, until you started playing. In the preparation, I always felt like the underdog. And but after we played a couple holes, then I was playing golf, and then I had my stuff to worry about. And fortunately, I had a lot of success in the international JCs. Lanny finished third, and I finished second. And A lot of good players were in that field. So that happened when I was 16, and then I won the national championship when I was 17.
John, I understand that a few years back you got to take your team and go back and visit Twin Hills, and you were able to walk out to that 17th green. And tell us what you were showing them, and because that's the hole that you won the match play and were crowned national champions.
Well, so in all fairness, when the finals started, for some reason I was relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of see that my opponent was a little nervous. And on the front nine, he just really didn't play very well. And I did play well. So that after six holes, after nine holes, I'm six up. And we get to turn to the back nine. And then all of a sudden, his true talent comes out. He birdies 10. He birdies 13. He birdies 14. He birdies 16. Then I figured I had him closed down on 17 because I'd hit it to about 8 feet and he'd hit it to about 35 feet, and he makes that.
Wow.
And so I made the 8-footer that won. And when I went back to the golf course, you have to understand this is, 40 years later, 50 mm-hmm. years later. An awful lot of trees on this golf course made it very tight, and you actually had to hit around trees to get to the green. And a lot of those trees were gone.
Right.
And so it had the fairway and the rough. And Pontus, who just won last week on the Corn Ferry Tour, was there, and Matt Moot. And when Matt got through, he said, "That's the tightest golf course I've ever seen in my life." And that was without the trees.
Mm.
So, but it was the people out there treated. I told them why I wanted to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of rolled out the carpet for me. I walked into the pro shop. Don't know if you're aware, when you play in really big events, there's a table and every competitor has to sign a poster.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the tournament, they give the poster to the club as a memento of the event that they hosted.
Mm-hmm.
And so 50 years later, I walk in and I see little Johnny Crooks' signature. It had faded a little bit, but it was still there.
John, what led you to decide to attend the University of Houston?
We didn't have nearly the information then as we have now. And I knew nobody that went to the University of Houston. I knew that they were the best team in the nation, and they'd been the best team in the nation for a long time. I think at one time they'd won 13 out of 15 national championships, and so many in a row. And well, it just made sense that if I'm the national champion, maybe I should go to where the best team in the country was. I had a chance to go to Wake Forest. And when I say that, people are going to go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, right." But I lived 4 miles from Wake Forest.
Right.
And so I kind of wanted to get away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And Coach Dave Williams called me a few times, and he was a salesman, and he made me feel like I could play, and so I went to Houston.
Tell us a little bit about Coach Williams. What did you learn from him?
Coach Williams was a Christian, and he was a man that didn't mind expressing his faith, and he didn't mind talking to young men about doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked to us more about how we should respect the game and accept the responsibility and do our best for the other people who had sacrificed to let us be there than he did golf shots or hitting balls or but he was a coach's coach.
And you've told me in the past that he liked for y'all to go compete. He didn't care as much for y'all to, you know, bang balls on the range or anything. He wanted to see how you handled it out on the course, right?
I wasn't playing very well, and I asked him. I said, "Coach, do you mind if I take a couple weeks off and just kind of get my game in order and work on my golf swing?" And he said, "Nope." He said, "You learn how to play golf on the golf course, not on a driving range." And so, I never had that opportunity to go out and hit balls. Now, Johnny Mahaffey won a PGA, and Doug Olson was an All-American from Oregon. And the two of them, really driven athletes that used to like to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was about a five-mile drive from the athletic dorm at Houston to the Rice Bowl. And I say the Rice Bowl because all around the Rice Bowl was just this perfect Bermuda grass. No golf course, but just perfect Bermuda. And so we'd leave. I got to join them at 6 o'clock in the morning. We'd leave to go out, and we'd hit balls until about 7:15. Then we could come back and go to class and then play golf in the afternoon. So if you wanted to practice, you kind of had to do it on your own.
John, tell us about how you got started in the game of golf. Did you have professional playing ambitions? And how did your professional career start?
It didn't. My professional career. So when I was 20, what did they call us back then? They had a name for athletes like me. We were hardship cases. And so what that means is that our grades weren't real good and that we decided to do something else. So I tried to turn pro at the age of 20, and I missed advancing to get my card by a couple of shots. And so back then, if you played in that tournament, that was your declaration of being a professional. And that meant for 2 years you weren't allowed to play in any other kind of events. Well, you couldn't play in PGA events because you weren't a member of the PGA, and you couldn't play in an amateur event because you were professional. And so for a couple years there, I was just in no man's land. And my daughter was born, and we moved to Zebulon, North Carolina. And so I just kind of got away from golf and got into the habit of making trying to earn a living.
Tell us, you mentioned your daughter being born. Tell us how you met your wife, Susan.
So I had come back from Houston, and I decided that because I'd gone to Houston in mid-year, and I wanted to get some hours, and so Wake Forest was just down the road, and so I signed up for two classes, and the first day in my algebra class, I noticed a young lady, and then when I went to the English class, I noticed she was in that class too, and so the next day, I got there early enough that I could sit directly behind her, and in between the two classes, I got up a nerve to speak to her, and I asked her if she did her homework, and that's how we got started.
John, you shared with me in the past the story about how when you were practicing one time, you were trying to beat Lanny Watkins to the practice tee in the morning.
Well, that was part of my attempt to get my tour card, and one of the sites that that prospective professionals were playing was Tanglewood, which is outside of west side of Winston-Salem. And so being from Winston-Salem, I would drive up and stay with Dad and Mom, and I'd go out and I'd play every day out at Tanglewood. And Lanny was doing the same thing. And we had played enough golf together. We knew each other. And so we started playing, and we kind of had a set tee time about 9 o'clock, and so I'd want to practice, and I'd get there at 7:30, and he was already practicing, and so the next day I'd get there at 7, and he was already practicing, and so then I go in and talk to the people in the pro shop, and I ask them, what time does he get here? I mean, I'd like to beat him to the tee once. And they said, well, there's a guard gate when you go into Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
And his car would already be at the guard gate when the pros drove up to go through the guard gate. And so that's the first time I realized that there were actually people in the world that love golf so much that they'd rather hit a golf ball than sleep.
Well, yeah, and it worked for Lanny Watkins, 21 tour wins, yeah. PGA champion. But that's, you know, sometimes there's no substitute for hard work and effort, right?
He was the hardest worker I ever saw.
Our guest today on Tales from the Creek is Hall of Fame golf coach John Crooks. John, tell us about what led to you and Susan and your family moving to Buies Creek back in the mid-'80s.
So Susan had gone to nursing school in Raleigh and was an RN, and she was working as an RN. And she had been doing that for about 10 years, and she'd gone about as far with being an RN as she wanted to go. She could be a head nurse, but she didn't want to do that. She actually liked working with the patients, and I guess she was approaching burnout, and she wanted to do something else. And so her father and her brother were both attorneys, and so at a family function, being an attorney kind of was one of those ideas that came out on the table, and then it just started to, somebody planted a seed, and one thing led to another, and she took the LSAT and did very, very well, and applied to Campbell, and Campbell accepted her, and the rest is history. We came to Buies Creek, 1984.
And I understand she finished very highly in her class, correct?
Number one.
John, tell us about how you became involved with the Campbell golf team before you were on staff.
So I can say this to you because you knew who Wendell Carr was. Mm-hmm. Wendell Carr was the athletic director at Campbell. But more importantly, Wendell Carr was a legend in Winston-Salem,
mm-hmm.
because he had been the starting center in the middle 50s when the two best basketball teams in the country were, or at least in North Carolina, were Carolina, who went on to win a national championship, mm-hmm. and Wake Forest, who won several Dixie Classics.
Right.
And so when I met him, I was in awe. And Campbell was a little smaller than it is mm-hmm. now. We used to have athletic meetings where everybody in the athletic department met in a classroom, and there were 33 chairs, and there were 31 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was everybody. There was the people who worked outside and the people, the secretaries and everybody. And but before then, I was still competitive, and I was still playing. And if I wanted to play golf in the afternoon, this is going to sound bad, but if I wanted to play with some good players, you know, Joe Enns was working in the pro shop, but he mm-hmm. couldn't get out too often. And the best players were the college students.
Right.
And so I started playing with some of them. And Wendell saw that, and he asked me one time to work his camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd worked the camp, and I guess we got to know each other, and then I became the volunteer assistant coach before there was a title.
Right.
And so I helped the team and for about 3 years, and then one day he asked me if that's something that I'd like to do, be the coach. And about 2 years or 3 years earlier, Susan had graduated from law school, and she was practicing, and it was a good time for a change in my career, and I did, and best thing that ever happened to me.
You remember the terms when he first hired you?
Well, so when we talk about terms, I think you're talking about maybe contracts or stuff like that. And Wendell never messed with the contract.
Correct.
Okay. Wendell was more of the idea man, and he turned that over to the people in the business office. And the people in the business office called me and offered me the job and told me how much money they'd give me. And I kind of laughed at them and I said, thank you very much, but I'm not interested. And so they called me back and they found some more money. And I go, look, if you're gonna, if you want to have a coach, then there have to be full time. And it's not, and no, I can't go to work for them.
Right.
And so they called me back a third time. And I said, look, every time you've called me back, you found considerably more money. I go, can I keep turning you down? And they said, this is your last call. And so I accepted it. And I became the coach. They told me that I was the coach like on May the 1st. I don't think I signed a contract until maybe the 15th or something. And but I'd already started recruiting and doing other stuff and on the phone. That's how I got started.
1 year later, Wendell comes back and I guess offers you the opportunity to coach a women's golf team that had sort of been competing for or been in existence for two seasons before that. How did that come about, John?
Again, I'm talking about things that happened a long time ago. And while it would have been nice if Wendell had come to me and asked me that, I got an invitation to breakfast with the president.
I know how that goes.
And that took place on Monday mornings. And so you got up and got dressed and went in, and there was Dr. Wiggins and John Robertson and Dr. Wallace and business people. And so they were talking about, Dr. Wiggins said, well, they're thinking about doing something with the women's team. And what did I think about women's golf at Campbell? And I said, well, sir, I think it's just a huge embarrassment. I go, I'm trying to build a program, and the team that Campbell put out last year shot some really high scores, and a lot of people look at the newspaper and all they see is the Campbell score started with 100, and they didn't make the distinction between men or women. And so I just think it ought to, you know, the men ought to have the team that needs to be the good one and move forward. I may have said, you don't need the women's team. And then he said, well, we're going to have the women's team. Now, you're here today to see if you can coach the women's team. And I said, oh, well, Dr. Wiggins, I don't know anything about women's golf. I know golf. But I'd kind of be starting from scratch. And he said, well, we want you to do that. And I said, well, again, if we're going to coach golf, it has to be full-time. It can't be one team gets more attention than another. And so I'd need the same resources. And I said same pay, and that didn't fly. Anyway, so I became the women's coach and been doing it for 34 years.
John, I've got to hear your recollection of, air quotes, recruiting at Marshbanks Dining Hall that first semester that you took the job.
Okay, so I start in May. I was supposed to have a team in August. They may not have been the worst team in the country, but if they weren't far from it. And so, you know, you're trying to recruit somebody to come in 2.5 months.
Right.
And I was able to get two people. And right before the start of our first tournament, Coach Carr said, oh, by the way, last year there were times that we only played with four. And that was an NCAA violation. And so you can't show up with just four. You have to have five. Well, I only had four. And so Marshbanks, my wife and I went over to Marshbanks, and we stood in line. And as the girls came through, I asked them if they owned any golf clubs. And one girl finally said yes. And I asked her if she wanted a expense-paid trip to Stanton, Virginia. She said, well, I've got a date Saturday night. Can I date my, can I still go on my date? I go, nope. So anyway, that's how I got started.
And some of those were two-sport athletes, a couple of women's basketball players, Amy Prince, Dee Dee Gwynn ended up playing for you. Cheryl Fletcher was a very good softball player, and she must have had a decent swing because she could really hit the softball.
She could really hit the golf ball. And she was, you know, that's one of those people that she's one of those athletes that had it been golf instead of softball, she would have been really a champion there.
Wow.
And so, but she could only play for a semester.
Sure.
Because then softball season was starting. And so that's why I had to use, I found out that one of my guys, Lou Messini, was dating a young lady, and she would go to the range with him. And so she had bought both golf clubs. And so she was on the team tour.
John, what was your initial recruiting strategy? What kind of player were you looking for?
Whenever I went recruiting, it became real obvious to me that the ones I wanted didn't want me.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones I wanted, everybody else was after.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to come up with something or some kind of story that got their attention. And, you know, while we didn't have a team or we didn't have a lot going for us, we did have Keith Hills. And when I'd start talking about Keith Hills and different shots and different holes and different things, then I would get people's attention. And then after, I said, you know, we're starting from scratch. So all you have to do is you have to get better. And that'll be a slow process. And that's what we did, and we kept that goal in front of us.
Your first year as men's head coach, Dwayne Bach was a senior. He would become the first and still the only four-time first-team all-conference player in Campbell golf history. Dwayne had some classes to finish up, and so he served as your student assistant coach in the 91-92 year. And then that summer, Dwayne went on to play in the prestigious North and South Amateur down in Pinehurst and then goes on and wins it. What do you remember about it, that experience with?
Well, Dwayne was the perfect coach in that he knew the players real well.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how to distinguish between their personal life and their golf life. And whenever I was around him and them, that's what the focus was on. And people, all the other members of the team really respected Dwayne because he was a good player. And we got through the first year. Dwayne did real well. He got into the North-South. And one of the great amateurs in the United States was a young man by the name of Jay Siegel, passed away in the last month or two. And Dwayne had beaten Jay Siegel in, I think, the semifinals or the quarterfinals, and he was going to have a chance to play with in the finals. And so I went down, and his brother was caddying for him, but it started raining, and it started raining after about nine holes, and then it just rained until the point that the umbrella was no good, and the finals were 36 holes, and so they played 18 holes. They had like an hour or something break in between, and then they went back out. So what I did was I got Dwayne to take off his pants. And I took his pants, and I got a hair dryer, and went into the men's locker room and dried his pants so that when he teed off for the afternoon round, he would, at least his pants would be dry. And he went on to win the golf tournament, and he had a really good career in a Canadian tour. Mm-hmm. And right now, he's killing it on the PGA Tour as a caddy.
Right. Were you able to share, and even in the run up to it, or during that week, any of the lessons that you had learned from competing at such a high level? Share that advice with Dwayne for that.
Well, during the course of the year, mm-hmm. we talked about certain things. Dwayne was a big guy, mm-hmm. but he wasn't necessarily a long hitter. Mm-hmm. He positioned the ball well, and he realized his parents had taught him early on the importance of the short game. And so he just practiced his short game time and time and time again. And so did I help him with some things with his swing? Just yes, but we're talking about maybe a little setup change or mm-hmm. something that to help him maybe to hit it a little more in the center of the club face. But when I got a hold of when I joined Dwayne on the men's golf team, he was pretty good already.
John, you take over the job, the men's job, and before the fall semester of 1990, the women's job 1 year later. Your men win back-to-back-to-back Big South men's championships, 92, 93, 94. And here, your women, who might have been the worst team in the country or could see it from there, a year and a half later, they win back-to-back in 93 and 94. How did you so quickly put together such competitive teams?
So my first team consisted of Janet Wooten.
Mm-hmm.
I had coached her brother, and Janet transferred in from Auburn. And Jennifer Lehman from Canada was my first real recruit from the women's side. And Maria Maldonado joined us. And those were three very determined young ladies, very talented young ladies, and they were very competitive with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found early on is that competition between teammates is more effective than any coach speak that there's ever been. That they may listen to what the coach has to say, and it might be a good message, but they're still doing everything in their power to beat that other player. And so that's kind of, they were the core, and they started, and we had growing pains, and Jennifer won a conference championship. Janet won a conference championship. I don't know if Maria did. I think she finished in the top 10 quite often.
She was a four-time all-conference player.
Right.
As well.
But Maria won other tournaments.
Right.
And so the three of them had skills, and when it was their week, they were good, really good.
John, I know it's hard to single out people from 35 years of coaching, but I'm always curious about, do you recall a player or two that you saw the greatest growth? How much improvement from the day they stepped on campus until graduation day?
Well, I've told her this, and so this is not some secret. So right now, I am fortunate enough to be in a position with my men and women's team that we're looking for the best people in the world, mm-hmm. really, that can come to Campbell and help our team get better. Well, I was in a situation where I needed a body.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a letter from a young lady in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter started out like this. I just won the award for the most improved handicap at my club.
Mm-hmm.
And she had gone from being a 36 handicapper to an 18 handicapper. And she wanted a place that she could come and practice and get better. Well, an 18 handicapper can break 100, and I didn't have too many people that could break 100, and so I immediately responded. And 2 days after I responded, she and her father drive up to Keith Hills in their RV from Canada, and he wanted to see if I was for real. And then we met, we talked. Jennifer came to school, and I think I'm right. But the first five rounds of golf she played, I believe she shot 98. And after every 98, the tears followed. And after the fourth or fifth time, she was upset because she was letting down the team, mm-hmm. her parents, her club, her school, Canada. She just had the weight of the world, and she wanted me to know that she was just better than that. And you could see it. And she got better, and she got better. And so a little more than 2.5 years later, down in Charleston, South Carolina, she finishes the tournament, and she's tied for the lead for the conference championship. We have a sudden-death playoff, and she wins. And so she becomes the Big South Conference Player of the Year. And to go from an 18 handicap to 2.5 years later being the Conference Player of the Year, I kind of felt like that was somebody that I had an impact on.
John, for years I had media members ask me to describe the makeup of our golf teams here at Campbell. And my stock answer was, simply that the sun never sets on Campbell Golf. And that didn't matter where someone lived in Buies Creek or halfway around the world. You would recruit them as long as they'd be a good fit here. How did you start recruiting internationally? How has that process changed? Because literally, you know, you've had players that their hometown is Buies Creek. Braxton Wins, Brett McClam from just down the road in Coates, North Carolina. And then you've had people from halfway across the world. Tell us a little bit about expanding your recruiting.
We had some good teams at Campbell, but the best team at Campbell was the men and women's tennis team.
Mm-hmm.
And Kenny Doyle was the coach. And when I came to Campbell, he had, of course, my first year, I'm not paying attention to a whole lot of the other mm-hmm. sports. But was impressed that that Campbell's men and Campbell's women had won every single conference match that they had. And that streak lasted for three straight years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to him and I go, "What are you doing? How is this possible?" And he goes, "Well," he said, "Campbell's a Division I team, and being a Division I team, we're going to be judged up against all of the biggest and best universities in the country. And in the state of North Carolina, there are a lot of household names of universities, and it's going to be hard. It was hard for me to recruit the best tennis player in the state of North Carolina, but he found out that if he went someplace else, that he could, whether he went up north or went to Canada or went to Europe, that those people looked for an opportunity to play, and that he would give them an opportunity, and they came in and they just loved it. And so I started dabbling,
mm-hmm.
and my first few years everybody was from the States, and then we moved to Canada, and then on the women's side, I kind of hit the jackpot in Argentina,
mm-hmm.
and by my sixth year of coaching the women, I had the entire Argentine women's national team at Campbell playing, and that's where we were recognized as one of the best teams in the country, went to the NCAA Nationals up at Ohio State, and finished 14th in the nation. And so then you just talk to good players about who are other good players.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had two teams, I had to rely on other people's opinions a lot. But if somebody told me they'd be a good player or a good fit at Campbell, and they had to type grades, and when I talked to them, they felt like they were the type of people we were looking for, then I gave them a chance, and that proved to me. I made more good decisions. I made some bad ones, too. But I was very fortunate about the people that I was able to bring in.
Well, and it seems like the people who came here from wherever and they embraced this place, you know, they're playing against players younger and older than they are, and I'm sure those parents are walking and talking to people and checking up on Campbell through people who had the families of people who had already been here. So it works two-way street, right?
Just word of mouth. People that when they look down at the newspaper and they see that Campbell wins a conference championship, the truth is the people in England didn't know the Big South from the Atlantic Coast Conference. Mm-hmm. And so they had a chance to join a winning program. And then we threw in Keith Hills, and we threw in the fact that I had a little bit of experience as a player. And it just, we were able to recruit some really good players.
John, you've coached golfers from six continents. I'm pretty sure the golfing community is not that great in Antarctica, so you haven't focused any of your attention there. But what makes this place, this small place of, you know, roughly 2,000 residents plus the campus, what makes this such a good spot for people from all over the world with all sorts of different backgrounds to attend school and to compete?
So Campbell obviously is a small school. The team is small. The men's team and the women's team spend a lot of time together. The people out at Keith Hills saw the improvement on the men's team and the women's team, and the members just embraced the Campbell students. And so even today, if my team goes out to the driving range, there'll be five or six members that'll come up to them and, you know, how'd you play last week? How's things going? How are things back home? And they just felt comfortable here. And people may make jokes about Campbell is out in the middle of nowhere, but that's exactly what a lot of them needed. They needed a place where they could work on their English and they could work on their studies, and they didn't have a lot of distractions. And then they started being successful, and then they realized that they weren't missing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Then, and so that word got out. And again, word of mouth. I'd like to tell you I was a great recruiter, but I was able to identify some talent, and we happened to have a culture. Now, I know people talk a lot about use that word in coaching. And all I can tell you is that the first players on the team, whether it was Dwayne Bach or whether it was Maria Maldonado or Janet Wooten or David Mathis, they wanted to play. They wanted to play. They took advantage of the facilities. They practiced every day. They did their work, and they came to the golf course, and they just wanted to get better. And so, and then what I tell them all, if you do well in the classroom, you'll do well on the golf course. And if you don't do well in the classroom, then the whole time you're on the golf course, you're going to be worried about your grades, and that'll suffer. So you have to start with the academics, and you have to get out in front of it because we miss a lot of classes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stay on top there, the golf will come, and it has.
This concludes part one of our Tales from the Creek conversation with Coach John Crooks. Part two will be released in the next couple of weeks.